Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 16th of September 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 50 and we are currently looking at British history and we're also looking at European history and the movement of the tribes that came into Europe and founded the nations there that we have today, particularly the northern nations. And as we did in the last episode, we also have a special guest with us today. We have Truthvids from truthvids.org. And we also have my regular co-host, Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Truthvids, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's truthvids.net, by the way, but that's okay.
Sorry about that. I always get confused between .net, .org and .com. So truthvids.net. Patriarch, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show. How is life treating you?
Hey, Sven. I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me back. And yes, been all right. I had spent a week in Greece, actually, which I never saw some of the cultural aspects of Greece before. It was the foundation of our heritage, really, and our ancestors, although it's obviously slightly different people now, although they're still largely white, to be honest. But it was interesting to see a lot of stuff because it's our history. It's really kind of one of the main hubs of our history, isn't it?
Yeah, that must be absolutely fascinating to go around and see these ancient ruins that they have there. Have you seen any in particular that stand out to you?
To be honest, didn't get to see too much of the historical side. We did have a trip planned to Thessalonica, but that didn't come to fruition. But we plan to go back one day and just do a full-on sort of historic tour of different places.
Yeah, that'd be excellent to see the old amphitheatres and the old temples, Colosseum, all that sort of thing. I've never actually been there myself. And of course, we also have a lot of the old Grecian relics in the London Museum. But as I say, today we're going to be talking again about Odin and his people. And we're going to be mainly using Haberman's book, Tracing Our Ancestors. And I actually missed out a section in the last episode, so we will begin with that. For about four centuries, those Asia or Mighty Asian, that's the people that moved into Europe with Odin, stayed in Asia land until the 3rd century AD, when under the leadership of Odin, they started on the westwards move again and headed straight along the shores of the Baltic to the North Sea coast, where they appear as the Angles. In their westwards push, they came into contact with their cousins, the Getae, or the Goths, whom they scattered northwards into Gotland, or Sweden, and southwards into Germany. There are other people in Sweden besides the Goths, some of the Donsk people of the Danites settled there centuries before our era, and other Scythian tribes. But besides the Lapps of the extreme north, all the Scandinavians came from that cradle of humanity south of the Black and Caspian Seas. The so-called Nordic group is an important part of the Aryan race, but to that race also belong the Jews, whose features are derived from a strong infusion of Edomite and Khazar blood. Some of the present-day Jews are the descendants of those who escaped the Roman Wars of AD 70 and 135. Mr. Hitler and his professors will yet find that out before long, and perhaps to their sorrow. However, our professors also know as little about our race as the Germans do about theirs, because for over a century, our universities and seminaries imitated everything that the German skeptics thought, and now the whole intellectual world is befuddled. So we have two important points to make there. We've got Odin's people, the Asia. They actually came in from Asia, and they were south of the Black and the Caspian Seas, and they've now made their way to the Baltic. They've made their way to Sweden in about the 3rd century, which is the time when the most famous King Odin lived. And then we also have this comment here about the Jews actually being descended from Judah, but also with a strong infusion of Edomite blood, which of course meant that they were Canaanites. And this is actually the earliest reference that I've found to that. Of course, there are references to the Edomites being the Jews going all the way back to Flavius Josephus. But this is the first book that I've actually found that points this out. And he is questioning this because Hitler was saying that he assumed that the Jews were the same people as the tribe of Judah in the Old Testament. But if they were half Edomite, then they were no longer the Israelites of the Old Testament, and they were actually the Canaanites. So this is at the point, I think, when people started realizing this, and I think Christian identity came about just after this period. But this is the first reference that I've actually found to that in a book, and as I say, it happened at the same time as the Second World War was going on. Truthvids, what are your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, I find that fascinating. He was really ahead of his time, right? Because most British Israel and, you know, seed line writers, you know, before Christian identity was really solidifying, they weren't fully aware of this, right? They were kind of, they didn't quite understand. They just assumed they were the tribe of Judah and that the Europeans were the other 11 tribes. But here he's realized this, and you see that slowly, bit by bit, you know, future people put this together. And obviously Hitler didn't realize this at that point. You know, and obviously he was preoccupied with a war to look into all this. But I do find that fascinating. As for like the Goths coming from the East, of course, modern, you know, quote unquote historians, they'll claim that they originate from Sweden, right? That they just suddenly decided to migrate into Europe and just overrun the Roman Empire. But you, if you read Jordanus, he says that they came from the east as well. He locates their origin from just above the Caucasus Mountains. That's as far as he could go back. Obviously, if we read other historians like this guy has, you can realize that they actually came from the Middle East and then eventually, you know, round, either over the Caucasus Mountains or around. And that's how they came to there. And eventually more and more tribes were coming in, and they kept competing for land, and they kept getting pushed further and further west, and eventually that's why they overrun the Roman Empire, right? There were just too many of them, and they sought the better lands, right?
And we also had the two different types as well. We had the ruling class, and we had the thralls. So there must have been people there in Sweden already, but just not very many people until Odin's people arrived. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yes, I've heard before actually from normies that, you know, they accused Hitler of wanting to make Jesus white and stuff, you know, sort of to almost make Christianity in line with, you know, the Aryan race, which of course he was onto something. But like you say, he didn't, he assumed that all of the Jews were kind of Judah, or at least I'm not sure if he was aware of the connection, Europeans' connection to the Israelites or not, but he definitely wanted to make Christianity more ethnocentric towards whites.
Yeah, I think people always knew that the Edomites had become blended with the tribe of Judah, because Flavius Josephus wrote about it and Strabo wrote about it, but I don't think people actually thought about what that actually meant. And that was what was changing in the 1930s. People were thinking, well, what does that actually mean? Well, it means they're no longer the tribe of Judah, doesn't it? And of course, nobody had really clicked on that before. You had British Israel, which had worked out that the European nations were the tribes of Israel, but they just assumed that the tribe of Judah was still exactly the same, even though the history was telling us that it was different. And I think Hitler found it. I think he found it easier to just continue saying that the Jews were the Israel of the Old Testament, just because he thought that would be easier. Because, of course, that contradicts with the truth, actually contradicts with the propaganda that the National Socialists were putting out. Well, getting back to Habermann here, during the first century BC, Rome was the mistress of the world. But not even Caesar attempted to extend his dominions into Germany, the land of the Teutons. When around 6 AD, Varus, the Roman general, invaded Germany, he got only as far as Westphalia. Hermann, or Arminius, a Saxon chieftain, united the German tribes and destroyed the Roman army, consisting of three legions, in 9 AD in the forest of Teutoburg. This was one of the decisive battles of history, and Rome was compelled to relinquish her grip on Germany. It was the second time that Israel, God's battle axe, came into collision with the fourth world empire of Daniel and checked the expansion of that empire. The victory over the Roman legions is commemorated in a gigantic monument, 170 feet in height, crowned by the figure of Arminius with a drawn sword, erected in 1875 near the German city of Detmold in Westphalia. And this is shown on plate 22 in the book. It's a fantastic statue. I'm sure some of our listeners will have actually seen it with this figure of this Celtic-looking warrior commemorating this battle with Rome. And, of course, he's saying here that it's this author recognises that the Saxons were Israel, and he recognises that the vision of Daniel, where there were four world empires, and each one of them got smashed, and then there was a new empire that arose up after it, and that this was a fulfillment of prophecy that Israel would do that to Rome. After that defeat, the Romans kept on the left bank of the Rhine, but the Teutons soon followed them there, and great campaigns took place during the next century. In one battle, 80,000 Romans were slain, and in 103 BC, 300,000 of the Teutons were slain in two great battles at Aix and Milan. To produce armies that could sustain such wars as these, the country of the Teutons must have covered a very large area of the German and Russian forests. It is scarcely likely that about the same period, and in much the same country, there would be three separate peoples called by such similar names as Gutones, Teutons, and Jotuns. And that's The Origin of the English by Major D. Weldon. So he's saying that the Goths, the Gutones, the Teutons, they were all the same people. However, the great Gothic invasions of the Roman Empire did not come until the 4th century and were caused by the sons of the mighty Odin, who became the chieftains of the various Teutonic tribes and thus founded the Confederacy of the Visigoths, or the Western Goths. Odin himself retired northwards into Denmark and southern Sweden, where he died, and Odin Sea in Denmark still commemorates his coming. Trufid, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the Germanic, people, that they must have extended all the way back, to the north of the Caucasus Mountains, even further to the east of the Caspian Sea, right into the Rhine, right? That was all a mass of Germanic people until eventually we set up our own, nations and et cetera. But I'm really surprised that he put together that the fourth kingdom is the Roman Empire. You know, it shows that he's really on the ball. He's also bringing in the Bible here and studying it. And that the fifth empire was the Germanic people, the stone cut out of the mountain that would smash that fourth empire to pieces. And that fifth empire is, of course, the Germanic people, us, the Europeans. All churches always deny that, and they try to, refit all prophecy to make some other explanation for that. But also those nations that would form from that mountain were promised to last forever. So we do have a guarantee that no matter how bad things get, and, especially now how bleak it's looking, that God has promised that our European nations will endure, and that he's promised to protect them till the end, right?
Well, I like the way it also ties in the Germans and the Russians, and we can see that there was this close friendship back then, and it was all Nordic peoples that were, the Kievan Rus, and it was in between Germany and Russia. And even today, we see there are close links between East Germany and Russia, and if it wasn't for the interference of America, I think Germany and Russia would actually be much closer together. Patriarch, any thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, no, it's quite amazing to say how accurate the scriptures have been fulfilled in this way. And is this the second to last empire? Well, there's the empire after that is the one with steel and Mary Clay, isn't it? That basically kind of just crumbles, and so that's the last empire before the final.
Trufids, do you want to elaborate upon that, the steel that was mingled with the feet of clay at the bottom of the statue?
Yeah, that's the true explanation why the Roman Empire crumbled, right? Modern historians will always claim that it was the economy, or it was decadence, and it really was that they were bringing in You know, slaves from all across, you know, the Middle East and North Africa, and gradually they started to blend. And I believe it was the first century that one of the emperors made all the slaves equal citizens. And then that's when it really started to decline quickly, because then they could all intermarry, and it all started to crumble, right? And then they just couldn't withstand the Germanic tribes anymore, because we had kept harmonious, right? We wouldn't mix outside the Germanic tribes. And that's why we eventually just crushed the Roman Empire, right?
So they were saying that they had men of iron that were mingled with men of clay. And that's what that dream represents.
I thought that was more relevant to modern day as well, though. Or am I mistaken on that? With today's climate, you know, with multiculturalism and globalism.
Yeah, it was prophesied to happen again in the end times. That's in Jeremiah, where he says that I will mix the seed of men, you know, Adamites, with the seed of beast, and that would happen in the end time. And he also has a prophecy where he sees a vision of all our cities, and he states that it's overrun with devils, right? So you can put it together and realize that eventually, and sorry, one more, that Christ said in the end days, it will be like the days of Noah again. So yeah, it was prophesied to happen again towards the end.
And multiculturalism has occurred again and again and again throughout history, with the same result at the end of it, the collapse of the civilization. It's almost like a warning that the end of the civilization is coming once multiculturalism hits it. And there have always been cheerleaders for it as well. I mean, L.A. Waddell found translated texts going right the way back to the Hittite Empire, where the Hittites were celebrating the fact that they had civilized the Aborigine tribes around them, and they were intermarrying with them, and they thought that this was a wonderful thing. And of course, that led to the collapse of their empire. So, and it's the same thing that we see today with people saying, "Oh, diversity is a strength. Let's celebrate multiculturalism." And it's exactly the same thing. It's just gone on and on over and over again. And there's always been a group of people that recognized it and struggled against it. And we happen to be those people today. But it was the same people that were struggling against it back then that then made their way into Europe to get away from it, because Europe was the only place that you could get away from it back then. Of course, now we haven't got anywhere that we can flee to, but so long as we retain our knowledge of this and we prevent ourselves from doing this, there will always be a remnant of white people there that a new civilization could always spring forth from. This is the other thing. Civilization is carried by the civilization bearing race, and it flowers again wherever there are enough of that race. And that's why we see this rise and fall of civilizations throughout history. Getting back to Haberman here, the Reverend Milner in his genealogical chart shows that Odin was a descendant of Priam, the king of Troy, and thus also of the house of Judah Zara, like Gallum, the conqueror of Ireland, and Brutus, the patriarch of Britain. And I'll also say there, also Rome was started by a descendant of Priam, the king of Troy. Aeneas, I believe it was one of his descendants, Silvanus possibly, married the daughter of Latium, who was the king of Latium. And then they founded Rome, basically, the city of Rome, which is why Roman aristocracy would intermarry with the royalty from Britain, because they knew that the Britons came from Brutus, that also came from the royalty of Troy, and they knew that their aristocracy also came from the royalty of Troy. And now we see here that Odin is also descended from the royalty of Troy. Milner's authorities for this genealogical chart are the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, the Icelandic Landfordgatal, and a Herald's College manuscript. The latter manuscript tells that Odin, in 250 AD, married Freya, the daughter of Cadwalder, king of Silurea. And we've also talked about this Cadwalder as well. Although it might have been an earlier one, I think Cadwalder is more a title, like viceroy, rather than the actual name of a king. But this was one of the British kings and one of the British princesses that Odin married in 250 AD, and therefore she was also of the line of Brutus. From the sons of Odin and Freya is descended Rurik, the founder of the Russian Empire in 840, the House of Wettin, that has furnished the royal families of Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Saxony, and Coburg-Gotha, and the House of Guelph, to which belong the houses of Hanover, Brunswick, Lüneburg, Mecklenburg, Bavaria, and a host of other German noble families. Thus, we see how Judah has furnished the scepters for Israel. So we can see that all the royal families here are interlinked, and the Norse ones go back to Odin, but if you go back from Odin, you can see that it goes back to Priam, the king of Troy, and we know that the royal house of Troy was descended from Zara Judah. Zara's twin was Pharah's Judah, and that's where the house of David comes from, that stayed in the Holy Land. Truefids, do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think he would have been probably a direct descendant from King David, right? I imagine. But they're also intermarrying, as you can see, you know, with other monarchies around, even back then, you know, before all the Germanic kingdoms got set up. And I remember I told you I'd read somewhere that Odin, that Freya was actually British, but I couldn't find where it was. But I'm glad you found it here, that they're saying that, you know, Freya, that the legendary Freya, who they say is a goddess, really, she was just a British princess, or at least, you know, descended from Brutus, right? Which is astonishing, right? Even then, Odin wanted to marry a direct descendant from the British, and it shows you, you know, our ancestry. Even back then, the great king of the Germanic people, that's who he wanted to intermarry. And here he's linked a few royal families, also all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms in England, they were all descended from Odin, not just Wessex, but originally Mercia was the dominant power before Wessex rose up. That they also had Otto, I believe his name was, I'm probably wrong there, but he was a direct descendant from Odin, but also the other kingdoms, Northumbria, Sussex, Kent, Essex, East Anglia, they all had kings from Odin, right?
So Odin was from the house of David, and then he married Freya, who was from the house of Zara Judah, and that's what gave them their legitimacy to rule. That's where this origin of this divine right to rule actually comes from. It all comes from Judah, going back to there. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I was just wondering, based on last week when we mentioned there was kind of multiple Odins, which one this was? Was this kind of like the founding figure?
Yes, this was in around about 250 AD, I think. And I mean, last week I was saying, well, I find it a little hard to believe that that within 100 years or so that they were already worshipping Odin. But I think basically older myths and the word Adonai for Lord, I think that must have got melded with this King Odin, and because then, like the worship of him, we sort of then hear about going on into the 11th century. So it did go on for quite some time. But when we had the Saxons that came into Britain in the 5th and the 6th century, I think they're referred to as worshipping Odin. But when we look at the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, we can see that Odin was a king from just a few hundred years back. And it may well have been that they were worshipping this king from a few hundred years back, the same as the Romans used to worship Julius Caesar. This deification of kings has always gone on, and it also went on during the lifetime of the king, during the lifetime of Caesar, the Romans were worshipping him. So perhaps I may have been wrong thinking that it was a name that went back and it was an Odin from centuries before. I mean, it could be that was the Odin there from 250 AD. Oh, do you want to add something to that, Truefids?
No, I completely agree. That was always to legitimize their rule, right? If you were descended from a divine god, then, you know, no one else is worthy to rule. It has to be you. And it also ensures that your bloodline, that your son and your grandson, because you'll be set apart from just the common people, right?
So that gives their justification for ruling. Well, it appears, however, that a body of the Baltic Goths separated before the coming of Odin and moved southwards back to their former home along the Danube, where they appeared as the Ostrogoths under their king Ostrogotha. From Ostro, the name of Austria is derived. For a century, the Roman Empire stood against the Gothic invasion, the reason being that Christianity was spreading rapidly at that time in southern Europe. Wulfilas spread it from Constantinople, where he translated the Bible into Gothic. But many centuries were yet to pass before the northern Celtic peoples, the Saxons, Jutes and the Angles, should hear of Jesus Christ. In Sweden, Odin was deified, and the faith in him continued there until the 11th century AD. The reason why the north of Europe did not accept Christianity until centuries later was the invasion of the Huns, which drove a wedge between the Gothic nations of the north and the south. The Huns penetrated Europe as far west as northern France until in 451 their power was ended in the Battle of Chalons by the combined Roman and Gothic armies under Theodoric. And I think there might have been some British soldiers that were fighting there at the time. So we see there that Odin was deified after this, after this third century Odin that actually lived. He was then deified, and we see that we had the Bible being translated into Gothic around about this time by Wulfilas. I've heard of Wulfilas before. Maybe he's somebody that we should study some more. Treefids, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that shows you that Odin was at least 2.5 or 3 centuries after Christianity, right? So, and it's being the Bible's being translated into Gothic. It must have, there must have been missionaries, and it must have spread. So you can see all these ideas in the Germanic myths and paganism, that it's why it's so closely related to Christianity. As we said last time, you know, there's this big battle with the serpent, right? Which you realize in Revelation is just the fallen angels and their descendants. And, you know, where did they get this idea of giants from? You know, it must be they came from the Middle East and, you know, their ancestors were battling the giants in Canaan. It only got made into ice giants once they came into Sweden, the myth. And the whole idea of Loki, you know, it's very close to Lucifer. Originally, it would have been a hard sea, so it would have been Lucifer. And that's probably where we get the term lucky from, and lucky or Loki. And so you can see he was the bad guy, and you know, he spawned a wolf, and the enemies of Christ are described as wolves. He spawned the serpent. What will you understand? That's the fallen angels. And he was also, I believe, spawned hell. You know, they have the power of death. So you can see all these myths, really, they originate from the Bible and Christianity, and it shows you that the links there, right?
And also this split between the north and the south, with the Huns there in the middle, and then you had Christianity in the south, and then in the north you had these pagan myths that, as you were showing there, have their origination in Christianity. Patriarch, any thoughts?
I'm wondering, the Huns, which route did they take through Europe? Did they basically conquer as they went along? Or did they just kind of like take one direct route and then straight into kind of the center of in and around where Hungary is today?
I think they just stormed in and took over everything that was in their path, basically.
They came from the Massagetae, and so did the Goths as well. The Goths were just earlier, and then the Huns followed. So really, they're just the same people. And of course, the Huns dominated Europe for a while, especially under Attila the Hun, right? Yeah, but you can see that they had the exact same tactics as the Parthian Empire, right? That they had the bows and arrows, but they had those special barbed arrows, so they must have come from technology, where there once was an empire with infrastructure to produce all this and have a proper military structure and all that. And that's why they were such a threat to Rome, right?
So you think the Huns came from the Parthians? The Parthians, or a portion of the Parthians, eventually became the Huns?
I think so, because at that time the Persian Empire took over the Parthian Empire. So that must have drove a lot of them out. And that happened about, I believe, around the 3rd century. And then by the 4th century, we got these Huns coming in, right? So, you know, and it takes time to go all the way around, you know, to travel. It can take, you know, 100 years to gradually, you know, you keep getting pushed and you grow and you expand and then you keep moving and moving.
Well, it certainly all makes sense, doesn't it? All making their way in from the Near East there. Well, at the death of Theodosius in 395, the Roman Empire was divided by his two sons. Arcadius became the Emperor of the East, and Honorius became the Emperor of the West. But shortly after that, the Visigoths rose in rebellion and chose Alaric as their king. In 400 AD, they besieged Italy but were repulsed. A second invasion in 408 was more successful. Rome was besieged and taken and plundered by the Goths. From this blow, Rome never recovered, and from that time forward, rapidly declined, and that mortal blow was again delivered by the people of Israel, the Goths, who fulfilled their divinely appointed mission to break in pieces the nations. Three of the four empires in the vision of Daniel had been broken by the people of the Stone Kingdom, that of Babylon by Gobryas and the Gutti, that of Alexander by the Parthians, and now the fourth empire, Rome, began to crumble under the blows of the Stone Kingdom of Israel, which was the Visigoths. Truthfords, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and that shows you that the Roman Empire was basically relying on mercenaries from the Germanic tribes to defend themselves, and they were being a bit crafty and sneaky. They would take, say, the Franks from France and bring them over to the east to fight against you know the Germanic tribes in the east, and then they'd take the Goths to defend against the west, so that they weren't fighting their own people, but they, you know, they were moving them against other portions of the Germanic tribes to try and make sure that there wouldn't be rebellions. And but you can see this is why the Roman Empire was crumbling, because they didn't have their own native Italian Roman people in the empire. And if you read into it, many of the characters during this period, the military generals, they weren't even Romans, right? They were all Scythians and Franks. And, you know, you realize their genealogies, that they didn't even have Roman generals anymore. They were all Germanic tribes defending the Roman Empire against the Germanic tribes. It's crazy, right?
Yeah, it's rather like today when we have people that aren't ethnically British in the army. It's the same as in the Second World War when we tried to have Indians fighting in the army. Essentially mercenaries, rather than having people defending the nation, laying down their lives for their nation, having people fighting for money. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think, even in World War One and Two, there was, you know, there were multiple different nations fighting on different sides. But, I guess it was, you know, it was a crumbling nation. They just took what they could, what they could afford. But I think because they were so reliant on the funds, they just got bled dry, didn't they? And then they didn't have the wealth, financial wealth, to sustain. Whereas the difference with the other nations, where their manpower was kind of for free, I guess, you know, or not necessarily for free, but it came with less of a price. So it was a kind of a sustained force. So I guess that enabled them to just overpower them in the long run.
Yeah, they had to pay them phenomenal sums in gold, and then they got attacked and overrun and taken over in the end anyway. Well, that finishes with tracing our ancestors. I've got another quote that I want to use here, which is by E. Raymond Capt, and this is from Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets. And he says, the archaeological evidence indicates that the Angles and the Saxons comprised only the western fringe of the great Scythian horde that extended east as far as the Vistula River. The more easterly tribes, on finally reaching the Baltic, eventually made their way to the Danish islands. This is borne out by the close affinity between the archaeological finds in Denmark and those on the South Baltic coast. Only a very few migrated to Sweden, because at that time Sweden already had a surplus population. A new empire had been established in the northern half of Sweden, founded by the historical Odin. The account of Odin, as narrated by Snorri in the Lingling saga, states that Odin came from Asialand or Asia Heim, which was central Scythia. Odin assembled at Asgard, which was modern Kiev, once the capital of Asialand, a huge army which marched up the valley of the Dnieper, then westwards to the shore of the Baltic, which was called Pelagius Scythicum, and finally into Scandinavia. It was from Odin's army, known as the Sphere, that Sweden takes its name. In their own language, the Swedes call their country Sverige, the land of the sphere, and the date of Odin is given variously as between AD 200 and AD 300. In the Heralds College London, there is a very ancient manuscript deducing the Saxon kings from Adam and from David. Odin is listed in the genealogy, as is also his wife Freya, tracing the royal house of Britain back to David. So we see that we had David, the ancestor of Anna, the cousin of the Virgin Mary, down to Penardim through Leah of Judah. That's through Troy, so that must be Priam of Troy. And then we have Bran, who we've talked about, Caradoc, who we've talked about, Coilus, Lucius, who was the king that Christianized Britain. And then we get Cadwalder, and Cadwalder's daughter Freya marries Odin. So Odin is therefore descended through Troy from Judah. And then from him, we also get the Tudors, the Stuarts, the Plantagenets, the Hanoverians, the Saxe-Coburgs, the Danes, and King George V and Queen Mary. So we see that all of this royalty that we have today actually goes back all the way back to Troy and all the way back to King David. And we also see here that with Odin's people, that they took this name Scythia with them as well. You know, they came from central Scythia. On the western shore of the Baltic was called Pelagius Scythicum, and the English historians called Germany Scythia, and they knew that the Saxons were the Scythians, and that's where they were coming from. Truthfeeds, any thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, that whole giant mass was called Scythia. It was only from the Romans' perspective that they call it Germany, and then as England became, that the British Empire became dominant, we started calling them Germans as well, but they call themselves the Deutsch now, right? But yeah, this is fascinating how they all had the family trees from Judah. And that is what the, as you said, the divine right to rule. It was being a descendant from Judah, from Pharaoh Zerah, that it wasn't just, I believe in God and I should rule. It was actually the bloodline, the direct descendant, because that was the prophecy that they would rule over the Israelite people, right? That there is legitimacy in their claim.
Yeah, and they had to prove the legitimacy as well with the family tree that we can see there in this manuscript. There are also Welsh manuscripts which talk about this Cadwalder, Lucius, Freya. I mean, they're very well documented in the Welsh histories. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Yeah, just by this time, I guess the two bloodlines from Judah would have merged back in together, right? I think we mentioned that in a previous episode. And then also it was around about the time of the French Revolution, was it, where the bloodline kind of became thwarted?
Well, I'm not sure it became thwarted because, I mean, you got King George V and Queen Mary. I think with the French Revolution, there was lots of regicide that went on. But yeah, we had the bloodline of David blending with the bloodline of Zara, with the Tia Teffy that we talked about last time that came in through Ireland. We also see it going on here with Odin marrying Freya. So yeah, we got the blending of the Zara and the Pharaoh's bloodline, and the kings today, the royalty today, descend from them. Getting back to E. Raymond Kaptur, Odin introduced among the people a new religion, the tenets of which faith included the fatherhood of God, the immortality of the soul, future rewards and punishments, the consecration of valour, seeking ever to die in battle rather in peace, with this being the ultimate goal by which they might attain to Valhalla, or the Hall of Heroes, or heaven. After the death of Odin, his authority was transmitted to his five sons, whom he had placed on neighbouring thrones. In time, Odin came to be regarded by the early Scandinavians as a mythical god. From Odin's son Skjold descended the Skjoldans, a race of kings which long held the scepter of Denmark. Yngve, another son, reigned in Sweden, and from him sprung the Ynglings, a name by which the ancient sovereigns of that country were distinguished in history. Yet another son, Balder, became viceroy over the Angles, and from him the Anglo-Saxon princes all trace their origin. Horsa and Hengist, the two Saxon chiefs who fought the English in the 5th century, reckoned Odin, or Wodin in their dialect, as their ancestor. So we have a lot of proofs here for Odin not being a deity, but in actual fact being a king, because we have all his descendants that ended up being the monarchs of Sweden and the Angles and in Denmark. And we've got these places that were named after him. It's really surprising that we have people today that claim to be Odinists when Odin wasn't a divinity. He was just a famous king. Truthfeed, any thoughts on these descendants of Odin?
Yeah, that's fascinating. But also just the fact that he introduced Valhalla, right? The idea that you know, there's an afterlife. You know, this is all from the Bible, that the life you live, there's a purpose, and that eventually we're all judged for the good things we done in this life, right? Obviously, they had a bit of a warrior spin on it, that you have to die a glorious battle, and you know, that's fine. You know, really it's just dedicating your life to your people, right? That's what truly matters.
Well, that's Christian, isn't it? Love your neighbor as yourself. No greater love does a man have than to lay down his life for his brethren. You know, Christianity is just nationalism, basically. I mean, and it tells you that to worship God, you love your neighbor as yourself. So, I mean, people that say, oh, well, either, you know, you put your race first or you put your God first. Well, no, Christianity says if you put God first, the way that you show that, the way you demonstrate that is by putting your race first, putting your nation first. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Yeah, last week you made a point about the when Jesus said love thy neighbor, it's rooted in the Levitical law, and was it Deuteronomy? I can't quite remember, but I looked it up and it is pretty much bang on. It's you shall love, it's linked to not being kind of resentful towards your brother, and you shall love thy the sons of thy people as you love yourself. So it is literally just linked directly to your own people, isn't it?
Yeah, it defines neighbor. It explains it, doesn't it? It defines what it means by love thy neighbor, and it says that it means the children of thy people, the sons of thy people. It couldn't be more explicit that he's talking about your people. That's what it means by neighbor, not the opponents of your people or other people's.
Yeah, and also if Christ is, quoting laws in the Levitical laws, it's not just the Ten Commandments only. Clearly, also all the other laws are important, because people always say, oh, Christ never spoke against this law, or, like sodomy or something like that. He never said anything against that, so it's fine. But here you can see he's quoting Levitical law, so all the laws apply. They're all important on a thriving white civilization, right?
Yeah,
he said he came to fulfill the laws, didn't he? Not to abolish them, but to fulfill them and become the ultimate sacrifice and fulfillment of it, so that it wouldn't kind of apply to us anymore.
Yeah, these laws aren't abolished. I mean, obviously, our state do not enforce them today, but they should be. They're eternal laws. If you want a country and a nation and to function correctly, then those are the laws that you need. And the fact that we don't have those laws anymore, I mean, we don't even have the blood for blood law anymore. Somebody who murders somebody does not forfeit their life. We put them in prison, and that is a curse upon the state for doing that. So a lot of the problems we have today come from disregarding these laws that we're supposed to be following. Well, another principal progenitor of the inhabitants of Sweden were the Goths, a branch of the German Scythians, who occupied the southern half of the country known as Gothland. In Swedish, this area is called Gotariki, or the Kingdom of the Goths. The Goths also occupied the largest island in the Baltic, also called Gothland, and is today a Swedish possession. I guess Gothenburg as well in Sweden is named after them. On the western coast of Sweden, there is naturally an element of Dano-Norse blood. Due to the close proximity of Finland, the Swedes naturally established colonies around the coastlands where the Swedish language is still spoken today. The inland parts of Finland are occupied today by descendants of Tatar tribes, Feni, Ests and Lapps, that once occupied Sweden before being pushed out by the Goths and the Svea. Some of the Finns are descended from the old Goths who never crossed the Baltic. The Tatar tribes are believed to have once inhabited Central and Western Europe, but were pushed north by the Cimmerians as they fled westwards before the Scythians. About the year AD 330, an offshoot under the name of Visigoths broke away from the main body of the Goths, who were then often called the Ostrogoths. These Visigoths, or Western Goths under Alaric the Bold, invaded Italy in AD 400 and took Rome in 410. 4 years later, they extended their conquests to France and then to Spain. Their rule in France, however, ended in AD 507 when they were defeated by Clovis at Vougel. Their dominion in Spain was brought to an end in AD 711 when they were conquered by the Saracens, the Muslims, under Musa. So just within 100 years, the Muslims were already in Spain, because I think Muhammad was around in 500 AD, wasn't he? So this gives us some information about Finland. It was colonized by the same people. And of course, then we also have the Laplanders that are up there in the north, the reindeer herders. And it says here that they were the descendants of the Tatar tribes. Treefids, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it just shows you how literally the prophecy was fulfilled, right? That the mountain is the Germanic tribes, and then this boulder comes out and smashes the Roman Empire, and it's, you know, primarily the Ostrogoths, the Huns, and the Visigoths, right? But the mountain still stood and grew to fill the whole earth, right?
Yeah, and we can see that all of these northern European peoples, they all originate from this great horde that managed to make its way into Europe from the 5th century BC. And this is where they had their technology. They had their technology from the previous empires that they were a part of. Patriarch, any thoughts?
The Tartarian Empire. It would be good to do an episode on that, because, general assumption is that they're kind of more of a Mongolian people, right? So I'm assuming that they originated it as whites, at least.
I think so, yeah, Tartary. I think they originated as whites, and then over the years they might have had a Mongolian infusion, but I think they definitely started off as white people. Well, we'll leave E. Raymond Capt behind there, and we'll move to a pagan website. This is Blade Honer. And this is him talking about Odin and Odin's people. He says, obviously, these tales of divine descent were important to the ruling clans of the Scandinavian tribe. So he's pointing to the fact that they said that Odin had this divine descent, which we've identified as meaning that he came from the tribe of Judah. And he says, firstly, this served to legitimize the ruling power of these lineages. Secondly, they were a part of the mythology of the cult of sacred marriage in connection to kinship. The divine king had to marry a tribal Fulgia or goddess in order to be inaugurated. And as we see there, Odin had to marry Freya, who was again from the line of Judah. And the stories fit neatly in with the fact that pagan people tended to worship some of their ancestors as if they were divine beings. As such, origin stories involving the gods playing a role as human ancestors were a vital part of the official pagan cults of Scandinavian tribes. They were not just invented by Snorri or other medieval chroniclers of history, as some have erroneously suggested. And of course, we've been pointing this out as well with the family tree. Odin was an actual person. They were not just a Christian invention meant to discredit the gods. They were very much a part of pagan lore. existing side by side with other myths in which the gods are clearly supernatural beings or even allegories of higher spiritual mysteries. When Snorri told these stories, he may have added some, I mean, we know he added some details and perspectives that made these stories fit better into a general Christian medieval worldview. And he may have emphasized the role of gods as human ancestors in order to take out a perceived threat to the new religion. But he certainly did base these stories on lore that he had heard and knew, lore that had been passed down through the generations. And I think we can see also that these descendants actually exist. So that proves that Odin existed, these people existed. This is why I think we who are interested in pagan Norse lore should take Snorri's origin stories seriously, even if we cannot vouch for all the geographical or personal or historical details. We do not have to, and should not, blindly believe that Odin was in fact a man who travelled from the east, but we can recognise that some of our pagan ancestors certainly believed so, and that in reality the Indo-European prototypes of Odin, alongside many other prototypes to Norse gods and the religion of the pagan Norse, originally came into northwestern Europe with migrations of people who came out of Asia, because they did. And of course, what they mean by Asia there is the Near East, rather than India. But as we've seen, the Scythians did head all the way to India, the Eastern Scythians, carrying Buddhism with them, and they ended up going all the way down to Thailand and China. And then you had the Western Scythians, which made their way into Europe, and Odin was the leader of one of these movements that made their way into Europe. If you look at the structure of the stories, the general movement being described, you will start to see overwhelming similarities to a huge era of migration which actually did take place in European prehistory some 5,000 to 4,000 years ago, an era of upheaval and change that actually led to the forming of a proto-Norse culture alongside many other cultures of Indo-European type. This is too interesting a coincidence to be overlooked, and there is good reason to believe that the lore of such past movements and migrations actually was a part of the Norse pagan worldview, even if Snorri may have added a little here and there. And of course, the main movement was from 500 BC onwards, but there had been other movements into Europe, obviously because of the tin that was there in Cornwall. And we've heard about the ships that were heading off from that coast there in Israel, that and the Phoenicians, and all of these peoples were making their way in. But Odin's people were, I guess they must have been the last to actually make their way in. I'll just pause there for a bit for some comments. Truefids, any thoughts?
Yeah, it just shows you that, as I said last week, the Genesis 10 nations started in the Middle East. It was a nice warm climate. All the books say that it was a very fertile land, you know, lush, full of crops, fruit, everything. Not so much anymore. And particularly the Japhethites, right? Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, Japheth. Shem generally stayed in the Middle East. Ham went down south, primarily, you know, Egypt, Ethiopia, but the Japhethites went a bit north, and they were around the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea area, known as the Mosque tribes, the Tubali, Goma, and then the more famous ones would be the early Greeks, right? And, you know, you had the Thracians there, and then the other ones, but then gradually that they were pushed aside when this mass of Israelites started to migrate. And that's what they're talking about, that this mass, you know, people being pushed. Because when you think about it, if you live in that tropical, lush environment in the Middle East, why would you want to move north to the cold? Who would want to go live in Germany and Poland, or especially Sweden and Denmark? Why would you want to live there? No one would. But if you have no choice and you're moving there, you know, because you're fleeing your homeland and you're in a large flock with mass cattle, then eventually you're going to look for somewhere, and just that'll have to do, right? Europe, and we thrived regardless, even though we started with these harsh conditions, right?
So the central area of mankind was the Fertile Crescent. I mean, that was the fertile area. That was where the civilization started. And then you had colonists and pioneers that came out from those civilizations looking for resources that they could harvest and then bring back to the civilizations in the Middle East and the Near East. And you also had a civilization that was taking off in Anatolia. You had Troy and then the fall of Troy and the movement into Europe after that. And the descendants of the royal line of Troy starting up these monarchies. And then you had this other movement coming in after the Israelites were put up there by the Caspian Sea up above Assyria. And they moved in from the 5th century BC onwards. So you see this continual movement as they work their way into Europe as tribes, and with the names changing as they make their way in. That's why you hear all these different names of tribes, but they're actually the same people moving from one area to the next, because we've continually migrated for the whole time that we've been on the earth. We've migrated from one place to another. We are explorers. We are an adventurous race. We like to seek out new lands and conquer them and build civilizations. And finally, we ended up in Europe with the civilization that that we have here now. Patriarch, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's just as prophecy foretold, really. So yeah, it's come to fruition through the from the Abrahamic covenants, even to kind of Isaiah saying that saying to Israel to spread abroad to the east, northwest, and as far as you can, spread your tentacles and increase your stakes, and to absorb the nations. And so Israel was always destined to really just kind of swallow and engulf any existing peoples and nations within Europe. And like last week, we mentioned about the world populations. And so obviously around 500 BC, the world population wouldn't have been so large, but as the continuous migrations happened and births and, populations increased, much of Israel would have basically just swamped everything. So, yeah, it's just really mind-boggling to think how accurate, prophecy has been. And it's not even widely accepted, especially with today's Judeo-Christian narratives. They can't, it stops people from truly understanding their heritage.
I think it says there'll be as many as the sand of the sea and the stars of the sky. And it also says that all the other nations were given up, and Israel is the last one that's left at the end. So all the European nations, the European nations that make up America, New Zealand, Australia, and the countries in Europe, they are all Israel, according to the prophecy, and according to when you look at history, when you see the origins of these people, they all originate in the tribes of Israel. Getting back to the quotes here, in both stories, because there were two parts to the Eddas, in both stories, Snorri claimed that the Aesir were men from Asia who lived around the Black Sea area. But he seems to have had different sources as to whether they came from the southern or the northern side of the Black Sea. And that's because there are two different Eddas. In the prose Edda, Snorri claimed that the Aesir came from Troy in Anatolia, which is today's Turkey, and that they also had close connections to Thrace, which is Bulgaria mostly. In the Lingling saga, he claimed that they were rather from the northern side of the Black Sea, but to the east of the River Don, which provided the border between Europe and Asia. Interestingly, both of the areas proposed were among the first areas settled by Indo-European people when they began migrating from their original homes of the mountains and the steppes of West Central Asia. So I think there he's talking about this movement that came in from Troy, but then there's also the bit where it says here to the east of the River Don, and I'm wondering whether that might be Kiev, Asgard, that was built in Kiev. Truthfeeds, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's much more likely that that's more accurate, right? Northern side of the Black Sea, east of Don, that would be Ukraine, and that's where Odin was said to have first had his kingdom. Asgard, and then it came from there. The other point where he says Troy, I think that would have been the East Roman Empire, right? There wouldn't have been mass migrations through that. That was under the scope of the Roman Empire. But above that, Ukraine was out of their scope, right? But you know, you must remember that Snorri, he didn't have all the availability of technology we do today. You know, he's over in Iceland. He probably didn't have, you know, today we have amazing maps and we have all the history books and we have internet and we can double check. So I think he did an amazing job just from whatever tools and information he had available to try and, you know, piece this together and give this story that we can now read, right?
Yeah, and obviously it's got mythic elements to it, it's got legendary elements to it, divine elements to it, but there's a kernel of truth to it, that that's where these people came from. Odin was a king, this is where he got his right to rule from, and this is the origin story of Sweden and Germany and Russia, and this is where these people came from, and they were all one people. And he's obviously writing down these folk tales that he'd heard, that the people around him talked about. And also, I think Iceland was settled by the British, by British from northern Scotland and around about this time. So he would have had access to the British histories as well. And I think he would have been writing in this Colburn alphabet that we've talked about here before. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I think it's just fortunate that we've got guys like him that was able to collate a lot of the older research that might have been otherwise hidden to us, you know, in a modern age where a lot's kind of suppressed and kind of disregarded. So to have him, it kind of really helps to bridge the gaps and kind of add confluence to a lot of the modern day findings that we're able to gain from current technology. So it's just kind of helps to just create a clean line of information.
I do find it bizarre that people, you know, worship Odin today. You know, you get Odinists, and it's really the equivalent of the Romans that were worshipping Caesar, you know, which we would mock and say, well, how ridiculous, they're just worshipping a man. But it's the same thing here. And it's crazy that people would go back to that. We know what it is. It's just that the anti-Christian element is why they do this. But if they were to actually look at this, they would see that there's real history behind it. And this was the origins of these royal houses and the right to rule in the northern countries. Treefids, any final thoughts on all of this before we finish?
Yeah, I think that paganism that they have today, modern day, where they worship Odin, it's nothing like what the ancestors, you know, even the pagans then. Today it's all just degeneracy, right? And it's if our ancestors met you know, modern day pagans, they would just be disgusted by them, because the old pagans, that, you know, it's just because they didn't know better, but they were mighty warriors and they were farmers and you know, they were family people, but they just believed in the myths that they'd heard. But once they heard Christianity and they were exposed to the truth, they accepted Christianity, right?
Yeah, there are origin myths and obviously legends and folk tales that have become intermingled with them, often with a moral behind them. And as you say, once they came across Christianity, the Christianity evolved, and there were elements of these myths that got intermixed with the Christianity, such as things like Father Christmas that we talked about last week. Patriarch, any final thoughts today before we finish?
Just thanks, for more kind of informative education from you and Treefids.
Well, it's great to look at all this stuff. I do enjoy studying it, and I enjoy making the podcast with you two. So thank you very much for coming on today, Treefids.
Thanks for having me. I hope people look into this and realize that we came from the Middle East and that we are the Lost Tribes, right?
Definitely. Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Welcome. As always, it's a pleasure. Looking forward to more episodes.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.